Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I am joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone.
And Randy Olson.
Hi.
So today is the 75th anniversary of the first use of an atomic weapon in Hiroshima. And that is the subject of today's show, which is extremely, it can be very technical and complicated, and we're going to speak to just that aspect of it later. But to just get us started, the title of the show is A New Manner of Thinking and a Revolution of Thought, Philosophical Reflections on the 75th Anniversary of the Bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this phrase, a new manner of thinking and a revolution of thought, those are both verbatim phrases from two different anti-nuclear activists. A new manner of thinking was used by Albert Einstein and Shinzo Hamai, the first publicly elected mayor of Hiroshima, called for a revolution of thought. And we're going to be exploring thinking, basically past and current thinking, and maybe get into how should we think about this. There has been a very specific track that we have been pursuing that doesn't seem to be working. So that is our angle today. And I want to begin with a quote from Hamsa Khan. If you don't know that name, Hamsa Khan was a Korean philosopher, poet, peace and democracy activist. I believe he died in 1989. And he writes this, what are the roots for humanity? Thinking. Where do the roots take? In the good earth of fact. We see individuals and nations going strong until they start to wane not long after, and that is because their roots were not deep. So I like this quote about thinking, that in order to think, you need facts. And if you don't have facts, your thinking is not deep. And so I think at the very least with the nuclear issue, there is a lot of ignorance about it. Like, we know that these bombs exist. We know that we used them, that the United States was the only country to use them. And at least in the United States, as we briefly stated last week, at least in our circle, there's just, I was not educated about the nuclear issue. And last week, we all basically said the same thing, not until law school. So we'll get into that. But so if you need to develop a new manner of thinking and you need a revolution of thought regarding the nuclear issue, then we need facts about these weapons. And it just seems so overwhelming, right? Like nuclear science and so forth. So I think because of the overwhelming nature of this, we kind of just tune out. So we're going to try to create a clearing and like give a framework for going into this issue. And so to begin that discussion, let us just talk about how each of us, if at all, began to learn about the nuclear issue, the issue of nuclear weapons, the legality, morality of them, et cetera. And we're going to start with you, Taylor. So I believe the last show you said you were exposed to a little bit of education about nuclear weapons in law school. Is that correct?
Yeah, in law school. And after I said that, I realized I did learn about it in grad school. But even though I was studying political science with a concentration in international relations in undergrad, I don't remember thinking very deeply about the nuclear issue until, you know, grad school, when I was looking at more focused on international law. So it was definitely not high school.
Yeah, nor I in high school. So you, and this is going to come up later, so it's sort of like through the lens of international law that you're exposed to the nuclear issue.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and me too.
And that's like international law. I don't know if we've said this on the show, but it's definitely been said. In the United States, like if you go to law school, international law is not, you know, an area of focus. And if you do study international law, it's typically through an LLM, so after you get your JD. So it's just, it's not stressed in U.S. law schools. Some of them, but not all of them. And most law schools in the United States are focused on, you know, passing the bar exam, that kind of thing, and having a career in domestic law. But okay, so number one is this framework of international law is one way to get a handle on it. And then, Michael, what about you?
I think my first exposure to the sort of realm of nuclear war was when I was in fourth grade, my class read Sadako and the 1,000 Paper Cranes. And I think this was sort of meant to sort of just scare us and scar us as to how perfect nuclear warfare is. Just to like have that in your mind, like, oh my gosh, how could this ever happen? And then my next big exposure to it was my sophomore year of high school. We read John Hershey's 1946 book, Hiroshima. And that was just for, and it was interesting that both of these really focused on the direct human impacts of the weapons themselves. So you got to really understand that the severity of these weapons is extremely high and not something that should ever be used. But I think in terms of a really broad, deep international law like perspective, I have not had that. So I think, and like we said at the beginning of the show, like having all the facts to really think deep about the issue, yeah, I would say I'm still not all the way there in that respect, for sure.
So very cool that you learned about Sadako and the paper crane story. It's a very famous story, and there's in Hiroshima a children's peace monument, which I've seen, and it has, you know, so many thousands of paper cranes all over it. People from all over the world send paper cranes into it. And so, interesting, your exposure is like the human impact. And I think Sadako, like, she did not die right away. She contracted leukemia and died, I don't know, like a number of years after the... Do you remember how many years it was? It was like 8 years or something like this.
I do believe that's correct, yeah.
Okay. But so she died from radiation poisoning and ultimately leukemia. And so the human impact, and that this goes into the temporal dimension, that the impact of the detonation does not stop. Right? Like the radiation poison takes a number of years, it stays in the environment, et cetera. And then my exposure, like first meaningful exposure to the nuclear issue, was in law school in a class that I took called International Law and Weapons of Mass Destruction. And that course was very, very impactful on me. And I would say that that class changed my life because that exposed me to this advisory opinion, which we'll talk about, and the Hague and the International Court of Justice in the Peace Palace. Topics for another show. But there was this opinion and there was like this international legal discussion about whether these weapons are compatible with humanitarian law. And I had never even heard of humanitarian law, much less this decision. So it was really, like, the whole course was really focused on this decision. It was a great class at Michigan State University College of Law. It was taught by Elliot Meyerowitz. And that's where I was exposed to it. And that, like, actually I remember it was in that class that I learned about The Hague and I learned about the International Criminal Court. Mind you, this is, I'm already a PhD philosophy professor, and I'm learning about this in my second, I guess, doctoral degree. I was completely ignorant about this through a PhD in philosophy, and I think this is extremely important. And I'm still ignorant about it, and this is why we do this show, so that I try to ameliorate my ignorance just a little bit. But I learned about the Hague, the ICC, the ICJ, and that put me on a path to go there. I had to go see this thing for myself. And I just began doing a deeper dive. So it was through the framework of international law, like Taylor, that I was meaningfully exposed to nuclear weapons. Now, I should say in high school, I was exposed, and we did have mock Nuremberg trials, and I was Goebbels, the minister of propaganda. But we, and instead of, this is one of the critiques, that instead of talking about the misdeeds, and that's a bit loaded, because some people argue that the dropping of these bombs was morally correct. So let me rephrase. Instead of focusing on arguments that these weapons violate international law, the narrative that I was given in my high school, which was a public high school, was these Nuremberg trials were great, and the United States was like putting on trial the Nazis, but you know, other people have said that the United States was guilty of war crimes and Hiroshima, Nagasaki, as well as various bombing campaigns are among them. So, but that, I wasn't exposed to that in high school. I was exposed to the Nuremberg trials, but not the nuclear weapon thing in any meaningful way. And Randy, what about you?
To be honest, there's two answers. There's one answer that came my first encounter with like the nuclear conversation, which mm-hmm. answered the questions about what nuclear weapons are, and then why, which is a different conversation and a different set of answers and a different set of information. So the what occurred when I was very young. I grew up playing video games. My whole family was very involved, and family of software engineers, basically. And so there was a game called Total Annihilation, where it was a race to kill each other using military strategy, and basically, whichever team got to the nuclear weapons first won. That was like a fact of the game. And so from early on, I had this idea built right into my concepts of strategy and planning that once you hit that step, there was a significant advantage in a way that was actually, it would break the game. It was so much more powerful than everything else that, you know, you would be reckless in your pursuit of them. Which I think is really useful because now I have this firm idea built into my childhood, like gameplay intuitions, that there is a significant difference between this level of weaponry and, you know, stealth bombers with, you know, huge payloads, but that aren't nuclear. Like there's a big distinction between the kind of bombs that we have now that we didn't have. Know, during World War II, at the beginning of World War II, right? So that's what. And then why didn't occur until 25 years later, really. I mean, it's been really recently when I started to ask, like, why would it get to this point? You know, like, why would humanity play Russian roulette with such a weapon? Because it's not, you know, and we're going to talk about this more, I imagine, but it's no longer just like a us versus them kind of situation. When we're dealing with nuclear weapons, when we're dealing with hydrogen bombs, we're talking about everybody dying if they're mm-hmm. used, not just the other dying. And I wanted to have a rationalization as to why such a thing would ever be on the table. And it took my investigation into depth psychology and really thinking about the divide in people that makes it all the way to the level of beliefs and what happens when somebody confronts you at the level of beliefs and what you're willing to do to them in order to hold your ground. And why a person would be willing to destroy everything for the sake of their beliefs, even when it means the destruction of them, their whole tribe, their whole family, their whole community. Like, doesn't it seem counterintuitive? And the answer really came down to no, and there is a perfectly rational structure. But it took a long time for me to put that together, and the nuclear issue was like the impetus to learn about people's beliefs.
And can you say more about the perfectly rational structure that explains it?
Yeah, so basically when somebody's belief system is questioned, it's more terrifying than death to the person, to the subjective mind, to the subjective experience of that person, right? Because when you're encountering the concept of death, it's actually something that you can put a category around. But when somebody asks you to question the things that you've built the category structures on, you're dealing with a bigger force than death, which is like the unknown or chaos or something in that, you know, that beyond category, which is larger than the box that death fits in for us. And so people are willing to pursue death as a means in order to avoid having to deal with the real unknown, right? Mm-hmm. The big question mark, which, mm-hmm. you know, you could put theological language around, and people do. And then you know, the second mm-hmm. there's theological language used on that set of questions, you're in a religious conflict, you're in a battle to the death, and there's no way around it because both sides have God behind them, basically. And it's mm-hmm. that fear of the big unknown, the fear of that kind of, you know, set of information that creates a rational structure. And yeah, I could go on, but I think that gets the
cool.
ground.
Yeah, thanks for that. Does anybody have any follow-up questions, comments in light of what's on the table now? Going once, going twice. Okay. So, all right, so that's how we were exposed to it. So let's start to just get some facts down. And I don't think I mentioned on this show that I teach philosophy at Central Michigan University. And Bertrand Russell is one of the most famous philosophers that you will encounter. But never in my grad school career, and even in even at CMU, there was a former professor. He's now left. His name is Jordan Lindbergh, and he taught a class called 20th Century Analytic Philosophy. And Bertrand Russell was discussed in that class, and that was after I just sat in on that class for fun. Nowhere in any of my grad education or any of the formal philosophy classes was I exposed to Bertrand Russell's peace activism until I started to, I had to teach myself. So Bertrand Russell was a peace activist, number one. But he was also a philosopher. And I'm saying that my formal education in philosophy did not at all include anything, any scintilla of his peace activism. And I think similarly when we teach Immanuel Kant in philosophy, his essay on perpetual peace is not taught. So this is just an incompleteness in formal philosophical education in the United States. And I don't think that I'm unique in not being exposed to the peace activism of various philosophers. But I want to mention Bertrand Russell because in 1955, so 10 years after the first use of the atomic bomb, Bertrand Russell joins with Albert Einstein, and that's extremely important. Like, we could just have a show on the 1955 Russell-Einstein Manifesto. it deserves its own show and maybe, you know, a topic for a future show. But it was really Bertrand Russell who was the organizer of the manifesto, and he got a number of scientists, including Albert Einstein, to sign this document, and you can look at it on our show resources page. But the reason why Albert Einstein is very important, apart from the fact that he was probably the most famous physicist, probably still is the most famous physicist in the world, nuclear weapons were developed by the United States in response to a letter that Einstein wrote to Franklin Roosevelt, saying that the Germans are working on this new kind of weapon, and we need to work on it too. So this is a very famous story about Albert Einstein writing to Roosevelt, and you can find the letter and so forth. Einstein was a pacifist, so this is like a sort of break in Einstein's pacifist narrative, that he tells Roosevelt, you really need to make this weapon. And so the Manhattan Project, so if the Russell Einstein Manifesto, the Manhattan Project, if these things are like you're hearing this for the first time, go and do your diligence and read up about the Manhattan Project or the Russell Einstein Manifesto. But the Manhattan Project is organized, so this is like the government, U.S. government project to make the weapon. There's an excellent film called Fat Man and Little Boy. Fat Man was the name of the bomb dropped in Nagasaki, and Little Boy was the name of the bomb dropped in Hiroshima. And that film sort of documents the Manhattan Project. But so we learned that Germany wasn't going to make this weapon. The technology was beyond them, and so we had this thing. And, you know, we dropped it on Japan instead. And I've been to the Hiroshima Museum in Hiroshima, and there's this display of documents, U.S. government documents, and one of them, which I have, if anybody wants me to throw it up on the show resource page, I'm happy to do so. But it basically says something like, this thing was so expensive to make, okay, in the United States, that we have to use it to justify the expense. Seriously. Okay. I saw that like on the wall. It's like was a declassified document that the American people will not be, you know, impressed if we don't use this weapon, given, you know, the billions that it cost. I mean, stunning, right?
Ridiculous. Like, what kind of argument is that?
I'm just stunned. Anyway, so this goes back to, like, are we thinking, like, what's going on here? But anyway, the 1955 Russell Einstein Manifesto, so Einstein ends up signing this thing in 1955, so you fast forward 10 years. And what's important about it, apart from the fact that Bertrand Russell, a philosopher, is involved, cool, is that it really underscores the responsibility of scientists. And so this is like, I think of this as a sort of step in the new way of thinking that we're talking about. Like, let's talk about individual responsibility, and let's talk about how scientists, when they're engaged in their craft, need to be, you know, like sort of mindful of how their expertise is being used, and to be on guard if the government is paying them, right? So if the government is harnessing the science, this is sort of like a call to be more mindful and to use science for peaceful uses. So this is where nuclear power comes in, that we can use this technology peacefully, and that involves nuclear power plants and so forth, which have had their share of accidents. But on this bit about individual responsibility, one of the signers of the Russell Einstein Manifesto was a scientist named Joseph Rotblat. He died, I think, in 2005, and he won the Nobel Peace Prize with the Pugwash conferences that he really spearheaded. And these still exist. They're annual meetings of scientists who get together to talk about responsibility and the nuclear issue. But I want to mention Joseph Rotblat because he walked off the Manhattan Project. He was, I think, the only scientist to walk off of the project and say, I'm not going to participate in this. And that goes to this, you know, he felt like this individual responsibility that he was not going to use his knowledge to contribute to the discovery of this. I'll just open it up to anybody who wants to speak about the 1955 Russell Einstein Manifesto or any of the points that were made. Taylor, I'll start. Taylor, anything to add?
Yeah, I was just going to make a point on the fact that nuclear energy can be used peacefully for nuclear
mm-hmm.
power plants.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a little bit of research on the International Atomic Energy Agency and how we've kind of organized around with different countries trying to use nuclear radiation for, you know, positive things. And it's done a lot of good. And at the same time, like, we do have to be mindful of it being the source of evil. But I know personally, I used to think that nuclear energy, everything nuclear was just like terrible and never should have been invented. And I do think the risk of nuclear bombs kind of outweigh in some ways, but also it has done a lot of good in some other forms. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay. Michael, anything to add?
Yeah, I agree with Taylor that the destructive power that can be used in the weapons themselves is extremely abhorrent. But the technological advances that have been furthered due to the harnessing of nuclear energy are quite impressive. I know it's just a recent example. Last week, NASA launched their latest rover to Mars, Perseverance, which runs off of nuclear power, giving it the capability to take rock samples and all sorts of things. But as for the 1955 Russell Einstein Manifesto, which I would highly encourage anyone listening to read because it was just absolutely miraculous. I really loved how it was just like this urgent call of like, wake up, people. Like, these weapons are they change the nature of how we function in a global society completely. Like, that was the line in the sand where everything before it is completely irrelevant because this changes everything, that you cannot think of warfare in the same sense as you've always thought of it as, you know, warring of nations, using conventional weapons, planes, all this stuff, because by using these weapons, you risk the entire annihilation of the human race. And that it also, which I found really interesting as well, there was also a lot of language that struck me as a universal peace in a way, and thinking of yourself as a global citizen and thinking of yourself in terms of we as a human species versus like this continent versus this one or this nation or this ideology against that one, because that kind of mindset would lead to the possible use of nuclear weapons. And I just thought it was a really powerful and profound document to read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also just want to remind us that this document is, and a lot of this, like, how can I say, like, being vigilant about nuclear weapons, right, is really connected to the Cold War. And so this is happening. This Russell Einstein Manifesto is occurring during the Cold War. And I've heard it said that, you know, after the Cold War ended, you know, this kind of vigilance about, you know, the nuclear issue, it's just it's lost its power because it's not the same. And that raises the question, well, why do we even have these things? So I just want to say, like, the Cold War is, like, that's a factor that's relevant to why this manifesto is made at all, but also the arsenals that exist and where we are today. The Cold War has a lot to do with it. Topic for another show. And, Randy, anything to add to what we've been saying?
Sure. There's a number of places to go. The first is, I suppose, playing, it's like giving the devil his due. you know, an enormous amount of funding that goes into, you know, a place like MIT, for example, comes from the Pentagon. And that doesn't mean that most of the research done at MIT is for the destruction of human life. And so, like, at the level of the individual, it's going to be exceedingly difficult to determine whether one person's scientific knowledge is being utilized for good or for evil, you know, five different levels up in terms of abstraction, 5 years in the future. Like, there's no easy way to determine whether or not that's taking place. And so, you know, I want to just put that out on the table as to, like, well, it's no surprise that scientists aren't walking off the walking off, you know, all the time, because it's difficult to determine whether or not there's actually that kind of negative impact of the technology down the line. So that's number one. Number two is we're moving into a sphere where almost all of the discoveries that we are going to be having from now forward have the same level of existential, like potential existential annihilation as the nuclear weapons did. I mean, if we take you know, femto technology seriously, if we take biotech seriously, if we take fusion tech seriously, no matter which major field we look at, the logical conclusion is the potential annihilation of the human race as we know it. And that can't be an impediment to research, that can't be an impediment to growth and development, because in some sense, someone's going to be doing it. And it's like we have an obligation to do it in an ethical way, which is a whole conversation, right? There's people much smarter than me talking about the ethics of certain kinds of science and certain kinds of research development that are happening all the time. And so, you know, I don't want to minimize the issue, but it's like we have to give the devil his due, right? We're going to be developing these kinds of things in far greater proportions than we have in the past due to the power of our technology now. And so the conversation we're having at this moment about how to make those kinds of ethical decisions based upon things from history and things from philosophy, at least in theory, is going to help us, you know, steer into a better direction moving forward.
Yeah. So I before the show, before we went live, I mentioned this movie, The Current War, which is about the battle for control of electric power between Einstein and Westinghouse. Now, electric power and whether, like, the current, whether it's DC or alternating current or direct current, and electric power seems, oh, this is like a good thing, because we're going to, like, illuminate cities and so forth. And by the way, the 1893 Chicago Columbian Exposition figures quite importantly in this story, I was happy to learn. And like, those of you in the know why I'm mentioning that. But also, it was being used for the electric chair. And it was like, this is a new invention by, you know, one that the state of New York wanted to use. So let's create a, quote, more humane way of killing people instead of hanging them. And so there's this really interesting, like we have this technology, and how you use it depends on, yeah, these other considerations, these ethical considerations, the virtues that are there at the time. And it's the same thing with nuclear technology, right? Like, we have this and we can use it for peaceful purposes or for nefarious purposes. And to round out this bit, I want to just mention this quote of Einstein. This is actually from, like, the last speech that he was working on. So there's this book called Einstein on Peace, and it's like it's a collection of all of his letters and writings on the topic. And this would be on page 639 if you should acquire this book. That's where I'm reading from. It's not on our show resources page. But Einstein writes, in essence, the conflict that exists today is no more than an old-style struggle for power. And then I'll add this because it relates to some things that were said earlier. Once again presented to mankind in semi-religious trappings. So as a teacher of ancient Greek philosophy, again, this the conflict that exists today is no more than an old-style struggle for power. And one wonders, like, if this is really what's going on, and it's also about power, political power, like, unless that's negotiated, then that's going to, you know, affect how this nuclear technology is used. And so you can't, to use the title of this wonderful film made by teenagers that's on our show resources page, The Genie in the Bottle Unleashed. You can't put the genie back into the bottle and then that genie has to live alongside, so Randy's point, like, the fear of the unknown, or I would put it like the fear of not being in control, and also this struggle for power. Like, these are very real human dimensions that we do fear the unknown. We do want to believe that we're in control, and there's this struggle for power. And so, yeah, we have to take this technology, these advancements, with that understanding of the human being, right? I leave it open to anybody to comment on before we turn to the 1996 ICJ opinion. Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, this idea that, you know, we need to invest in technology so that we have a better control over our environment, of course, is going to leak over into having more power to control other people through military, like, dominance. Like, those ideas, unfortunately, are forever married, and like we have to come to terms with that. And there's a similar danger where, you know, in the progress, like, in as we develop more and more advanced technology, the degree to which the disasters from unforeseen events is going to inevitably increase too, right? So, I mean, we can talk about some of the nuclear disasters. The one that I'm most acquainted with is Fukushima, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Fukushima accident, like, they had fail-safes built in. And, like, the plant did shut down. But the plant shut down and then was not able to, like, release the excess heat fast enough in order to not shut down in an explosive, devastating way. And so it's insane because, like, they have these meltdown protective measures in place with an unbelievably sophisticated degree of precision that would be completely mind-boggling for any individual to try to comprehend. And still, the unknown, right, the big question mark, the unpredictability of the world can come in at any point, and in the Fukushima example, be a, you know, 30-foot tidal wave that you can't really prepare for, because you don't always know, like, you can't know. And I think that's the main message, right? There's no way to truly predict anything about what's coming in the future, and the best thing we can do is guess, and we can make educated guesses, but, like, you have to work with what you have. And I think where I want to move with this is we're not taking seriously the information that we already have, right? I haven't done this poll, but I would be appalled by the percentage, how low it would be if we went around and actually asked people, you know, in America, maybe even people who live in Philadelphia, or, sorry, in Pennsylvania, like, what's on Three Mile Island, or what was on Three Mile Island, you know? Like, did anything special occur in 1979? And ask people, and I bet the vast majority would have no idea that there was a historical event related to, like, nuclear science that occurred there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's so many items that need to be taken seriously, then so that's my mm-hmm. comment, I suppose.
Right. So still a lot of ignorance about this issue. And anybody else want to chime in? Going once.
I would say that going back to the IAEA, and I'm sorry to bring this up, but I think it really emphasizes, you know, to your point about, you know, the ignorance of each person, that we need international organization at the highest level as well, and that people are often unaware of what is happening internationally, and we kind of just trust our government to organize themselves. And I think it's important, although I think the IAEA is a really good organization, I think it's important that people, you know, look at what kind of checks and balances are there, what kind of cooperation is there for these, you know, when there's a nuclear disaster because a power plant gets hit by a, you know, I think that there is this duty for us to, like, look at what they are doing, so we can say, you know, more specifically, we want these specific measures in place, or this isn't good enough. I think there is that moral duty to look into what is being done and how they are cooperating.
Cool. So there's this duty to understand, like, how we have organized the world. This is a theme that we've talked about in repeated shows, how we have organized the world around this technology and the peaceful use of it. And I'm going to play a clip about that after, Michael, you had something to say as well.
Yeah, I was just going to, like, if anyone's listening, it was sort of, you know, not 100% sure about all this nuclear stuff, if they're looking for a place to enter the forest, I would highly recommend John Oliver's HBO series Last Week Tonight. On July 28th, 2014, he did an entire episode on nuclear weapons, and it's kind of jarring and, like, sort of shell-shocking to get an idea of just how sort of fast and loose the people and the checks and balances that are meant to be enforced by the people who are supposed to enforce them. They really don't seem to care all that much about making sure that these missile silos are locked down, upgrading the equipment so you don't have an accidental sort of another third, like, Three Mile Island or Chernobyl sort of ordeal, and upgrading equipment so you no longer have floppy disks running the computers that control the, like, nuclear weapon missile silos and all of that. And, like Taylor was saying, that personal accountability of sort of educating yourself to then realize that there's quite a bit of catching up to do in terms of making sure that we have as much control over these things as we possibly can, and then demanding the change be implemented, because then you are aware of what needs to occur.
And what was the name of that HBO series again?
John Oliver's Last Week Tonight.
Okay. So that's and there's an episode from July 14th, did you say?
Yeah, July 28th, 2014.
If
anyone has access. Yeah.
Cool. July 28th, 2014, John Oliver, Way to Enter the Forest and Get a Handle Over It. So since we're talking about, okay, there is this international organization, and we have talked about this theme, organizing the world. I'm going to play a clip, and this is from a book talk on a book called Atomic Audit. It's a bit old. It's from 1998, but I found it very useful, and you can watch this whole talk on our show resources page. This is Robert Norris. And he is talking about how once you create the technology for nuclear weapons, so you have this in your military arsenal, that implies a whole nother dimension of organization. And so I'm going to play this clip. It's about a minute and 43 seconds.
A second thing I'd like to share with you is I think the book should sort of be read as a cautionary tale for others who might think about doing things like this. And we have that right before us because in May, as all of us know, both India and Pakistan detonated tests in their nations and are at the threshold of making some very, very large decisions about whether or not to go forward with building a nuclear arsenal. Now, I don't anticipate either of them building 70,000 nuclear weapons as we did, but even if you decide to build 770 or maybe 700, there are a lot of things that go with that. And what our book really shows is the way in which deciding to have a nuclear arsenal forces you to do a whole range of things. For the United States, it created a base structure that straddled the globe. You need intelligence to know what your adversaries are doing, and thus we had planes and satellites and all that goes with it, even human intelligence sources as well. A secrecy empire that is still largely in place and prevents others from examining what's going on. All of this and much, much more will be things that the Indians and or the Pakistanis will have to deal with if they decide to go forward and build an arsenal.
And that clip is from 1998, and India and Pakistan did go forward and build arsenals. but we're not talking about that fact, and that will come up if we get to on this show the Non-Proliferation Treaty and this decision in 2016 by the International Court of Justice. But the point there is that all this other stuff needs to be created, you know, to support the fact that you have these weapons. So like further organization is needed to support the weapon, and so the organization is on both fronts, right? So we have like this international organizing for peace, which we're about to talk more about, and then there's this international organization surrounding the weapon itself and being able to use it correctly, if that's accurate. But so we've been talking about the 1955 Russell-Einstein Manifesto a bit, and this little bit about individual responsibility of scientists. In 1996, and this is where I started to learn about this issue more deeply, as I said in the beginning, there was an opinion by the International Court of Justice, which is the court of the UN. So, again, another piece of this international organizing. So the UN has its own court. It sits in the Peace Palace in The Hague. And this wasn't a bona fide decision. It's an advisory opinion. Taylor, as you're a law student, do you want to say anything about the difference between an opinion and an advisory opinion, a decision and an advisory opinion?
Yeah, so an advisory opinion is requested it can be requested by the General Assembly. And it's usually treated as, like, of legal weight, but it's not technically a binding decision, but it's treated as such. A judge, like a decision between a decision in a case between two parties, so two states, is binding, legally binding.
Cool.
That pretty much sums it up. Yep.
Yeah, it does. So yeah, you're just getting like this advice, like, oh, court, can you render advice as to whether nuclear weapons are inherently illegal? That's really what the General Assembly was asking, and there was one dissenting opinion on whether or not the International Court of Justice should. I mean, this was a controversial thing for the International Court of Justice to do, to agree to render any judgment on this issue, and I think it was Judge Oda from Japan who rendered the only dissent. Dissenting opinions are extremely important to read, I found. But we're not going to talk about that, but rather the court did agree to opine and listen to the arguments. And in 1996, it decided in its opinion that I'm not going to read the whole language, but nuclear weapons would generally be contrary to the rules of international law applicable in armed conflict, and in particular, the principles and rules of humanitarian law. So generally, yes, these weapons are contrary to humanitarian law. So generally, yes. However, and, you know, there's always the however, there's always an except or unless. However, in view of the current state of international law, the court cannot conclude definitively whether the threat or use of nuclear weapons would be lawful or unlawful in an extreme circumstance of self-defense in which the very survival of a state would be at stake. So the opinion, again, it's not a decision binding on a state, as Taylor said, but it's like generally, yes, these really, yeah, they violate humanitarian law. However, if you really need to use them and your survival is at stake, we can't say whether it's wrong or right, illegal or illegal. I open it up if anybody wants to comment on that and the kind of thinking that's going on in such opinion.
It's like empty.
Okay, Taylor and then Randy.
Sorry, I remember being shocked by this opinion the first time I read it, especially because of the idea that in international humanitarian law about proportionality and about, mm-hmm. you know, making sure it's a targeted attack, right? You can't just attack a random civilian neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And obviously by its nature, you know, nuclear bombs are not going to be proportional to anything except for other nuclear bombs, and it's not going to be proportional to the military target achieved, and it's not going to, you know, distinguish between civilians and military targets at all. So I remember I was shocked because it seemed completely against everything I had learned in international law up until that point.
And the U.S. State Department, the lawyers from the State Department argued to the contrary of what you're stating, Taylor, that actually, and the court says, I didn't read, I actually intentionally omitted this language, which is, in view of the current state of international law and the elements of fact at its disposal. And it's like, we need, like, as you know, like the law needs facts. This is where it departs from philosophy, okay? Because philosophers really, like, they do their thing without any facts, actually. It's all, like, hypotheticals. But we need, like, the specific factual context here to render a proper judgment, and we don't have any facts. And what the United States said is, look, there, like, when you say, Taylor, and I'm just playing the advocate here, that it's not going to be proportional, the United States said that is a factual judgment, and like we can't say that. And the U.S. is definitely on record for saying there. And it's not the U.S. is not alone on this, by the way. Like many states argued this at the ICJ, that it is not these weapons are not intrinsically illegal because you need there could be a factual situation where the military objective, like the value of it, is proportional to the pain and death that you are perpetrating onto civilians. And so there is a sentence, I don't have the document in front of me, but it's something like, given a valuable enough military objective, an extreme loss of life is totally legal. Okay, that's the U.S. saying that. So that is a way of thinking, and I think that way of thinking, and I too was shocked when I read this, and for the reasons that you indicated, Taylor, as well. And, like, digging deeper into it, like, the more shocking thing is the it's this sort of deep inconsistency in international rhetoric, where on the one hand we speak about the inherent dignity of the person, And on the other hand, the person is totally expendable if that life is necessary to obtain this valuable military objective. So there's a utilitarian calculus. Like, we're weighing things. We're weighing lives against a military objective. And to me, that's totally inconsistent with any framework in which human dignity is front and center. I think that there's a fundamental inconsistency in how we speak about human dignity on the one hand, and then, you know, this military objectives on the other. And I think that eventually something's going to have to give way. And I think, I just want to say, like, I think Kant is somewhat aware of that, because Kant is the philosopher of human dignity. He is not a utilitarian. He is not a consequentialist. And I think that the way that we speak requires that kind of framework, and we're not there yet. And I want to say that that's another, like, new way of thinking, if you will. And I think that the path has been set insofar as human dignity is important, and who knows if it really is, but we speak as if it is. But I think that when you start to really analyze what that means, it's really not compatible with any government being able to say, well, yes, this military objective can outweigh even one life, but it is totally legitimate, right? Collateral damage is still an acceptable thing from armed conflict. And as long as that's the case, I don't know. That's why I'm shocked by it. And I shudder at the, you know, calling this law, actually. I really do. I leave it open to anyone.
Yeah, like this idea that, you know, nuclear weapons might be acceptable in an extreme circumstance of self-defense where the survival of a state's at stake. Like, how hard is it to make the argument that, well, everything that's occurring in a war where nuclear weapons are on the table involves the mm-hmm. very survival of the state, and therefore all things are permitted? Like, mm-hmm. like it took me 5 seconds to pull that together. So, you know, like, I don't understand how we can really call this, how we can treat this as anything to, you know, base our actions around. And, you know, I think that the same argument could eventually be used as a form of defense in the event that it was simply testing military technology, right? Like, well, if we don't test our technology, we could be faced with a situation where we are unprepared for, you know, nuclear weapon-based warfare in the future, and therefore the very survival of our state is in danger, right? And, like, yeah, of course it's reaching, but it's those exact lines of argument that people do use to get away with things like this, that we eventually have to point to them and say, like, look, yes, you can make a rational case for this, but that doesn't mean it's the only rational case, and it doesn't mean it's correct, even if it's logically sound.
Right. And, Michael, anything to add?
I, like the rest of you, was also really shocked to read the ICJ 1996 advisory opinion, just from the sense that, okay, even if you had, you know, like thinking of a military justification for using it, the weapons are just so monumentally destructive that even if you thought, oh, we'll just use it on this one specific military target, that weapon will easily affect everything else that's around that populated area, civilian industry, other neighboring nations who might not be involved in the conflict, and even the entire planet as a whole. Weapons are powerful enough where they'll go off, they'll radioize, all the radioactive particles will be jettisoned into the atmosphere. They will go around the planet, depending on where it is in the world and the direction of jet streams. That contaminates then completely other hemispheres of the globe. It's just, I don't understand. Like, I thought, like, wouldn't the risk of utter annihilation of the human population, like, be grounds to make any nuclear action completely abhorrent and illegal, when the entire annihilation of the human race is a possibility? I was completely shocked by it too.
Yeah, so I second this. Like, we need a new manner of thinking and a revolution of thought, because this is just, yeah, this doesn't sit well. And also this thing, like, okay, if the very survival of a state would be at stake, you know, North Korea can look at this, right, and say, well, our existence is threatened, and so we're totally, it's permissible to use this. Now, one way of reading this opinion is, and the United States has taken this line, that this is a political issue. It's not an issue to be adjudicated by a court, okay, that this is for politicians and diplomats to negotiate in their meetings and so forth, and this is not about, like, legal rights and duties and so forth. And one way to look at this opinion is that the ICJ is agreeing with that line of thought, that we're just not going to even – we're not going to decide on this. But it's like, it's an advisory opinion, so just go the whole nine, you know. It's like, it's not a binding decision, so, you know, speak your heart kind of thing. But and I think that there's some merit to this if you look more closely at what's happening with these international agreements. And I also want to say about, like, the testing. You know, there's something called the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which I haven't looked into at all, I confess, but I know that, like, it's a thing and it's related to the nuclear issue, and it hasn't been ratified, okay? And so there's been this attempt to try to limit nuclear testing, but there's not binding law. Yeah, does someone know about that treaty?
Well, I don't know anything about the treaty, but I mean, I can color in the justification, right? So, I mean, you know, the ICJ has this opinion in 1996 that we've been talking about, but there was this other conversation at the ICJ in 2016 about what was going on at the Marshall Islands, going, you know, dating back all the way to the 50s. And, mm-hmm. you know, for anybody who's listening, just search in on your computer, just look up, like, Bikini Island testing, bombs, something, anything mm-hmm. even approaching that, and you'll get information about these military tests of nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands or over the Marshall Islands that were like they were blowing up bombs in the sky, and it was way bigger than they expected. Like, the scientists underestimated the weapons. And the whole world found out. They're like, because these were happening in secret, right? And, you know, it's like these tests at, it was at Castle Bravo, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the explosions were so much bigger than they expected, and the radioactive contamination that, like, destroyed huge amounts of, like the explosion itself was bigger than they expected, and then the radioactive fallout was bigger than they expected, and the whole world was like, hey, wait a minute. Maybe we need to think about whether or not it's okay to do nuclear bomb tests in the atmosphere, because there's, like, a whole conversation about maybe this is doing things we don't understand. And that was in the 1950s, right? We're dealing with something that we haven't been able to come to terms with over 70 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're going to talk about the Marshall Islands case in a moment. But before we turn there, anybody else with any loose thoughts that need to be connected? Going once, going twice. Okay, so you mentioned the Marshall Islands testing. And so just to retrace our steps, we talked about the 1955 Russell Einstein Manifesto. So this statement about the responsibility of scientists. Then you have the International Court of Justice, this court of the UN, rendering this opinion that basically says we can't say whether it would be unlawful if you need it in an extreme case of self-defense. And we're all sort of shocked by that thinking, if you will. So I think the decision was rendered in 2016 in the Marshall Islands case. They brought the case in 2014. And what's so fascinating, this is a fascinating case, because the Marshall Islands is not seeking any kind of, like, compensation or remedy, right, for the illnesses and the destruction to the environment that resulted from this testing by the U.S. What the Marshall Islands did was attempt to file a suit in the International Court of Justice against the nuclear weapons states who signed this document called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I think it entered into force in 1970. Okay, and that document required the signatories to negotiate in good faith disarmament of their nuclear arsenals. So that's in 1970-ish. Okay, and so what the Marshall Islands does is basically say, hey, you're not doing that. So it's not even about, like, you did this testing and you caused all of this damage to human beings and to the environment. No, it's that we're waiting for you to disarm pursuant to the treaty obligations of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Article 6. And this is where we're requesting an injunction. We, like, want the court. This is such a fascinating case. We want the International Court of Justice to make the nuclear weapons states negotiate disarmament, because they pledged to do so in this treaty. That's all that the Marshall Islands is asking for. Is everybody clear on that? Does anybody want to add to that?
It sounds pretty noble, but no, please carry on.
Anybody else want to chime in? Yeah, it is noble. And
I second,
like,
Randy.
Like,
I third.
And it's so just like someone, like, do something and make these powers do what they pledge they would do. And what does the International Court of Justice do? I mean, and this, it's just, they say, we can't even hear this case. We can't even hear this case because there's not an actual disagreement. And I'm leaving out some technical things. Like, there was also at the ICJ, there were three countries that agreed to go in front of the ICJ and hear the complaint of the Marshall Islands. One was the UK, and that's the important one because the UK was a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The others were India and Pakistan, who are not signatories of the NPT because they didn't have nuclear weapons when the NPT came into existence. And they were sued for violating customary international laws. It gets complex. Let's just talk about the UK, who did sign and did pledge to negotiate disarmament in good faith. The UK's argument, which the court agreed with, was, hey, there's no disagreement here because we didn't know the Marshall Islands, like, had this beef. And the court agreed. And there were dissenting opinions, so it was like a 4-4 decision, and the president of the court had to cast the deciding vote. But the dissenters, you know, made the point that what you're doing is really narrowly defining what a genuine disagreement is. And you're making it, like, harder and harder for a country to seek relief through the ICJ, because it's a very technical definition of disagreement. That is, like, formal petitions need to be filed, and there have to be, like, complaints lodged with the right state entity. And the Marshall Islands had not done this. It's like, it just went to the ICJ and complained there. And the court's basically saying, you can't do that. And so, again, you know, the ICJ is sort of punting the decision and attempting, I think, to keep this issue in the realm of politics rather than international law. And this is the current thinking. This is where we are today. This is 2016. Anybody want to comment on the ICJ 2016 Marshall Islands, quote, decision?
What strikes me about the the issue around the term, what a disagreement is I, you know, Marshall Islands is a smaller entity than, you know, the United States or whatever, and it obviously doesn't have as much political weight in the international sphere. And so really, like, international law is like a tool that smaller countries or countries that don't have as much geopolitical influence should be able to use to make their point and to have to be protected. And I think that the idea of getting rid of it, the term disagreement, when obviously a nuclear war would like impact everyone or every country on the globe, is kind of problematic and almost pushes like international law so far in the corner on a myriad of like many issues, not just nuclear power.
Anybody else?
Yeah, there's this bureauc, like the layers of bureaucracy are showing the degree to which the courts are no longer really representing people in the way that they were originally intended to do. Because, I'm sorry, like, if we're going to think about nations as individuals for a moment, which there's a reason to use that framework, when two people disagree and are yelling at each other, it's pretty obvious when there's a disagreement. I've never seen two people who are in the middle of a real disagreement about a real conversation about something that was really important. I've never once seen that level of disagreement and been unsure as to whether or not a real disagreement was taking place, right?
But
conflict is very obvious.
But I would just chime in with that. Like, sometimes people don't know what they're disagreeing about. They may be, like, shouting at each other, but they don't know, like, they just disagree on a definition of something, for example.
Well, I think that, you know, determining the actual, like, epicenter of a conflict is absolutely part of a disagreement, right? I think that that's probably more often the actual cause of an argument than people realize. I totally agree with you. But that doesn't change the fact that there's a disagreement taking place, right? Mm-hmm. There's people screaming at each other. There's people whose hands are folded over, you know, over their chest. Their arms are crossed, and they're all grumpy on their face. Like, you can see there's clearly a disagreement taking place. And when the final decision, you know, the thing that closes the folder, and, you know, case closed, conversation over, when that occurs and the conclusion is, well, we couldn't really determine whether or not this was a real disagreement, it screams to me as, like, nonsense.
Well, I would say that it's not that they're saying we can't determine whether there's a disagreement. They're saying there is no disagreement. Okay, and so the disagreement, if you will, is between the majority and the minority in the court. So, like, one side says you need to have, like, this formal petition filing for there to be a disagreement that this court can hear. And they're not saying, like, there's no disagreement. It's just, like, the kind of disagreement that we can judge, that we can issue an opinion on, does not exist here. And the other side says, yes, it does. So there's a disagreement about disagreement, which, you know, I just think that's fun. But yeah, and it's technical. But I think this is just a way of punting the issue again. That's how I read it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like eventually somebody is going to have to address the issue directly and not sidestep it, not shift the goalposts, not move it down 50 years. Like, eventually we have to have these conversations as a species. And eventually we need to have the people who are in the best position that we can manage in order to adjudicate on an issue of this magnitude, say some things with substance. Like, eventually that's going to occur. And, you know, in 2016 we said, we're not ready. But fine. But eventually, it must occur. Like, there's an inevitability to this magnitude of issue that, like, can't be skirted forever.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else? Michael?
No, I truly agree with everything that was said, and I agree with Randy. It just seems, as we progressed and as tensions increased between, I guess, for an example, between the United States and China, both massive economic powers, both nuclear powers, that eventually it will come to a point where these international adjudicating bodies will have to make a stance and say either, yes, it's fine to do what, like, maintain these weapons, or no, there's just the ability to annihilate all of human life is completely contradictory to the advancement of the human civilization. And so, no, these weapons cannot be maintained for war purposes.
All right. We've been going for over an hour, and we're not completely through the outline. I do want to play one clip that is that helps with this conversation, I think. And it's like we've been talking about the ICJ, an international legal instruments, powers, if you will, in dealing with the nuclear issue. And we didn't really talk about the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but the conventional manner of thinking, if you will, is that we need like this international organization, international agreements, treaties, and so forth, and this is really the proper way, the proper means to denuclearize. Now, I'm going to play a clip. This is also Robert Norris from that same book talk from 1998, which is on our show resources page. He's not the author of Atomic Audit. He's a contributor, and he's like a pretty famous anti-nuclear intellectual in the United States. And so here he says something very interesting about another path to denuclearization that we haven't talked about. This is about three to 4 minutes, and then we will come back and wrap up after this 3 to 4 minute clip.
Well, we had 70,000, and that wasn't all at one time, of course. We're talking about a period where new ones were being deployed and old ones were being retired, so there was this constant turnover. And at the peak period, which was in the late 60s, about 1967 or so, there were at one time about 32,000 in the arsenal at the same time, which is a staggering number of about three dozen different varieties and in hundreds of places around the globe. And so I think we also need to ask ourselves, well, why did we get rid of so many over the years? And here I think is another sort of sub-theme in the book that I think still remains to be written about. Steve talked about the inter-service rivalry, which was a stimulus for driving the different services to want nuclear weapons. And that was certainly the case in the 1950s and 60s and probably into the early 70s. Our military believed that nuclear weapons were the things to have. And what we see happening is that for each weapon system, first there was an airplane bomb that was dropped out of various kinds of bombers and then made lighter so it could be dropped out of smaller airplanes. And then a whole host of missiles came into being. As weapons got smaller, both in weight and size, many more applications were possible, and the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines all wanted them. And so this caused this dramatic increase in the numbers through the 50s and 60s. And I would contend, and I think that history is still to be written, that it was this very same military that was enthusiastic about these weapons in the early years that began to have themselves second thoughts about all of this and began to get rid of these sort of one by one, mission by mission. And so what we have in the 70s and the 80s is reductions of the arsenal, elimination of certain types, and now we're down to a kind of a core group of about 10,000 that are left of about half a dozen or seven or eight different kinds. But some rather remarkable things have happened over the past decades, and it's been accelerated by the ending of the Cold War. The Navy, if we discount the ballistic missile submarines that still are there, and a few Tomahawk cruise missiles, don't have any other kinds of nuclear weapons. They've eliminated four or five different missions. The Army doesn't have any nuclear weapons anymore, nor does the Marines. And the Air Force only has missiles and bombs for various aircraft. So looking at that side of things, we see that the military has been very, very instrumental in, far more so than arms control treaties, I would contend, in getting rid of thousands of nuclear weapons.
So there you have it. He argues that the military is really the more successful agent in denuclearization and rather than international treaties. I don't know how to evaluate that claim. I thought that was a very interesting insight, and I just throw it into the conversation. Anybody want to respond to that? We're going to be ending soon, so if you don't have a response to that, anything else that's hanging out there? Taylor?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that there are so many angles that we've discussed to come at this issue or to look at this issue to enter the forest. And I would just recommend that everyone look into this a little bit further so that they can see it themselves and take advantage of the show resources, because this is probably one of the biggest issues of our time just because of the existential crisis it poses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on our show resources page, there's a link to the William Perry Project, and this was created to educate the public about the nuclear threat. And there's a lot of great resources on that, podcasts, as well as a course offered through WebEx, where William Perry himself is teaching at Stanford University. So there are a lot of things that you can do. You can start with the show resources page, and if you want, the William Perry Project is there. Cool. And Michael, anything?
One quote that I came across from the astronomer Carl Sagan that I felt really put into context the sheer futility of nuclear weapons in the modern age. And I'll read its quote. "Imagine a room awash in gasoline, and there are two implacable enemies in that room. One of them has 9,000 matches. The other has 7,000 matches. Each of them is concerned with who's ahead, who's stronger." I just felt that really puts into, at that point, the world, being the room awash in gasoline, it doesn't matter how many matches you have. If each side just has one, that's more than enough. That'll do the damage that will be intended. And even then some, the entire room will go up in flames and that'll be the end of that. And I completely, like Taylor said, this is an extremely important issue of our times. And I would encourage everyone to educate themselves. Like you said, Hope, there's tons out there to read, research, look at these important international decisions, look into the international organization, look at to what your government is doing in terms of making sure their nuclear arsenals are in check, what programs are in place to ensure that there are safeguards against the record of the ability to make sure nuclear accidents do not occur. And I definitely think that would go a long way in allowing the people to then have facts to stand on to then demand change for a more safer world.
Cool. Randy?
Well, the main thing for me is, for everyone to ask themselves very seriously how we got to this point and ask whether or not there's a coherent story, because making that coherent story part of the individual consciousness of, Making that complete narrative part of you is going to reveal some things. Even the attempt of it is going to reveal where, you have some gaps. But then, furthermore, ask yourself how a person might get to a point where the destruction of the entire human race would be an option that's on the table. And the awareness that that's on the table as a rational choice that someone might make, because that's been the state of the world for more than 70 years. And, it's not an accident. It's not a fluke. There's teams of people on both sides who are very, very well armed, who have thought about these things very hard for a very long time. And it's not arbitrary. And the disagreement is a real one. And it's built on a theological landscape. And the question is, what is that landscape, and how do we leverage it for the betterment of the world instead of the destruction?
And I'll just say, as we close out this show, and maybe we'll come back and continue to discuss this, because we didn't get through the entire outline, and there's a lot to be said about the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons and also the new strategy taken by the United States, which is a separate track from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I think that deserves some discussion, so perhaps we'll come back and discuss those things some more. But I do want to say, we've talked about there's a duty to educate yourself about this very important issue, and there's a lot of ignorance about it. And for the past 7 weeks or so, we were talking about the Korean War, and it's the forgotten war. And isn't it curious that, there's the forgotten war and then there's this issue, and they're together on the Korean Peninsula with North Korea. It is the issue. And I also want to say that this is not only the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's also the 75th anniversary of the UN. And the UN, the UN Charter, the preamble talks about we need to organize the world for peace, and the International Court of Justice is part of that. And that machinery was, we tried to use that to meaningfully address this issue, and it hasn't worked. That doesn't mean that there are not, there are judges at the UN, and I just want to call out the judge from Brazil, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name, but Antonio Cansado Trindade. I don't know, Taylor, do you know of him? Have you heard of him? Justice or Judge,
yes,
Trindade.
Yes, but I'm not sure how to pronounce his name.
Okay. Well, he's the judge from Brazil, and he did issue a dissent in the Marshall Islands case, and he's one of these. I've mentioned the humanization of international law. And he's like one of the card-carrying members. He marches under that banner, and he's really trying to get the international legal framework to be more attentive to individuals and to, as you said, Taylor, smaller states. So there are dissenting opinions, so pay attention to those. And I think that's all I have to say. So you've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Any last words, anyone, before we end today's conversation? No, I hear. Okay, so have a great weekend, and until next time.